Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Free Exchange. I'm Oliver Wiseman, Free Exchange host and editor of CapEx. My guest this week is Matthew Goodwin. Matthew is a political scientist at the University of Kent. In recent years, he's established a reputation as one of the most insightful and interesting observers of populist movements and insurgent parties. Matthew, along with co-author Roger Eatwell, has just published a book on the subject of national populism. In it, they do away with numerous myths about populism and offer a guide to the parties and ideas that, whether we like it or not, are setting the running in political systems across the West. I spoke to Matthew about his new book, about why populism is on the rise, what populism's opponents get wrong, and whether the likes of Donald Trump, Marine Le Pen, and Matteo Salvini are the new normal. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did.
So national populism, in the way that we define it, is a movement that prioritizes the interests and the culture of the nation and seeks to give voice to people who feel neglected or even as though they've been held in contempt by elites, whether political elites, economic, or even media. And that makes it distinctive from fascism, which was revolutionary and was much more focused on race and ethnicity. And national populism partly is, but also partly is not. And our book is about pushing back against some of these misleading caricatures.
And you're talking about national populism, not populism. So in that sense, maybe this is the wrong way of thinking about it, but you're talking about basically right-wing populism, not left-wing populism, in the sense that you're not talking about Corbyn or Syriza or these sort of arguably quite populist movements too.
That's right. We avoid the term right-wing because we do think that increasingly the right-left framework is coming under pressure. Left-wing populists are very different in that they principally prioritise class over national attachments. And they're also much more interested in economic issues than they are cultural issues. And national populism is also a term and a way of defining these movements that for us, I think, draws as much attention to what these movements seek to include than what they seek to exclude. Now, what I mean by that is the debate over populism, the global debate, focuses heavily on what populists want to exclude. So whether it's immigrants, minorities, the establishment, those kinds of things. But that, I would argue, distracts us from the power, the potency that comes with populism from what it seeks to include. And it's seeking to give voice to the national community, or at least to a conception of the national community. And that's really what allows it to get this durability that we often underestimate.
And so I'm going to put to you a version of recent political history. I'd say this is a sort of maybe the Nick Clegg version or the kind of Ramona version, which is that, or at least one of them, which is that the rise of expressions of what we're talking about, national populism, such as Trump and Brexit and so on, were the last howl of an older, whiter, less tolerant part of the electorate. This is a generational problem that will basically go away because essentially populist voters are dying and we've got newly minted younger voters are coming up on the inside. What's wrong with that theory as you see it?
Well, the first thing to say is that's a very popular theory because you read it often in the FT and The Economist, and Nick Clegg and Vince Cable has made a version of that, saying that Brexit was a byproduct of angry old white men who want to go back to the days of empire. There are a number of problems with that argument, but just before we get to the problems, just remember why it's so popular. It's so popular because of the implication. The implication is that if you think this is all about generational change, then you don't really need to do anything. It's just a waiting game. You just wait for these awkward populist voters effectively to die and be replaced by younger, tolerant, liberal generations.
In some cases with Brexit, that's explicitly the... another vote because X number of people have died.
Yeah, that idea is voiced frequently, and there's an economist who's actually calculated that if you assume birth and death rates remain the same, then Remain moves into a clear majority position by 2022, right? These fanciful calculations. There are a number of problems with that. Now, the first is if you look at the base of support for populism across the West in general, it's often younger than people think. It's from the under 40s or in some cases the under 30s. You know, Marine Le Pen in France did very well among young women. Matteo Salvini in Italy drew his support evenly from across different age groups. Brexit is not like those movements. Brexit was only partly populist. There was about 7 in 10 leavers who said they had voted for the UK Independence Party or they would consider doing so. But even Brexit, about half of 35 to 50-year-olds ended up voting to leave the European Union. 1 in 3 black and minority ethnic voters as well, by the way, which doesn't sit easily with Vince Cable's caricature. But also, that debate completely misses out life cycle effects. The fact that, you know, as each year of our lives go by, you and I will probably become 0.38% more conservative as each year passes. Now, you might already be there. I might already be there. Who knows? But the point about life cycle effects is that it reminds us that we're not on a linear generational journey, that we have changes, social changes, generational changes in how we see the world. The argument that was first put out there about generational change, by the way, was first made in the 70s when a chap called Ronald Inglehart argued that liberals were going to completely, and I mean economic and social liberals, were going to take over the world. And of course, those voters, many of whom are now voting for Trump or voting for Republicans, conservatives, and so on. So the progressive belief, at least, that you know the arc of history must always bend in their direction, I think you can actually challenge that. I think even if you don't agree with me and you think there is that this process is happening, I would still say, well, you are exaggerating the scale and the pace of that change. And who knows? You know, all kinds of things can happen, as young people in Europe are discovering. You know, sometimes, you know, young voters too feel left behind and shut out of the economic settlement.
It's also a very limited explanation, isn't it? Because it doesn't explain why now. It doesn't explain, you know, if the arc of history argument was true, then we would be sort of over. We would have been getting steadily less populist in our politics over the last 100 years. I mean, which obviously hasn't been how things have worked. So let's talk about another popular theory, which I'm sort of teeing you up here to knock down some of the other theories of populism, which is that basically, you can explain national populism. Pretty much all of it comes down to the financial crisis, and this is just the political turbulence that we feel after economic turbulence. What do you make of that kind of explanation?
Yeah, well, I mean, that it's a very popular view. It's found its expression in books like Crashed by Adam Tooze, which recently just came out, and again, he traces populism to the post-2008 crash. Martin Wolf in the FT has made similar arguments. We've had a vigorous discussion about the effects of China and Chinese imports, particularly on the Rust Belts and on parts of left behind Britain. But it's very misleading. If you just look at the life cycle of these movements, you know, they were often well on their way long before the collapse of Lehman Brothers. It doesn't explain why some of the most successful national populist movements have come in Switzerland, in the Netherlands, in Austria, in Sweden, in Poland. Strong, generally, economies, if not strong, certainly growing economies with low unemployment. And Northern Italy, you know, Lega and Matteo Salvini, again, very prosperous, quite secure areas. And I think, you know, these examples kind of push back against what, you know, the argument that I would suggest the left particularly likes, which is that all of this is about economic scarcity, that it is the old Marx line that anti-establishment, anti-immigration movements partly are driven by concerns over economic competition. The evidence, I would suggest, is nowhere near as convincing as they would have us believe.
And of course, what both of those explanations, the old white people and the economic explanations, have in common is, as you said, the first one that makes you think it's both sort of play into the biases of the people that peddled them, in the sense that they kind of make the populism problem go away. The implication of those being wrong is that the thing they have in common is that actually, these are not just protest votes. These are actually votes for a set of policies and ideas that national populist politicians are pushing. So, you know, your theory is one in which you actually have to take the ideas more seriously than, say, the Liberal Democrats or the Adam Tooses of this world would.
Yeah, and I think this is a critical point, that protest theory is very popular, again, among people who don't want to accept or deal with the fact that the grievances on which these movements are mobilising are firstly partly legitimate grievances, but are also leading people to vote for the national populist message, not just against the system and the status quo. And these parties, as we argue in the book, are making a number of promises to voters, that they are promising that they will put the people back into the conversation. They are promising that they will try to curb the influence of increasingly detached and at times quite insular political elites, and they are calling for greater economic protection or reformed political systems that give more power down to the people. Now, some of these parties do so while being openly xenophobic, and some of them do so while being openly Islamophobic at points. But in general, I think that the argument that all of this is just a kind of irrational temporary backlash against the status quo is misleading.
And your own theory, you and your co-author's own theory, comes under what you call the four D's. So do you want to talk us through those?
Yeah, so it's a device to get people interested in the evidence and the summary that there are four deep-rooted currents that are sweeping through Western political systems that are reshaping those systems from below and really creating some strong foundations for these movements. Distrust, deprivation, destruction, and de-alignment. And each of those really relates to some long-term trends within Western democracies that are going to supply these movements with ongoing potential. Distrust relates to the fact that large numbers of people, millions of people in the West, not only feel that they don't trust their elites, but they also feel that political parties and politicians have become increasingly less representative of society as a whole. Now, there are some legitimate criticisms there. Our politicians have, on balance, become less representative. They've become more highly educated, they've become more affluent, they've generally become more socially liberal. And you might say to me, Matt, what's the problem with that? I would say, well, it's not necessarily a problem as long as the policies that they enact are actually responding to every group in society in a roughly fair way. And what's clear is that non-graduates and workers are clearly not being responded to in an adequate fashion, and have good reason to feel that they're not at the table. In Britain, for example, only 3% of MPs have any experience of manual work. About 18% have only ever worked in politics. I mean, generally, we are not building a chamber that is full of diverse experiences. And without sort of labouring through all of them, destruction relates to kind of fears over national ways of life and values being destroyed by a period of unprecedented demographic change, a period of unprecedented immigration, particularly in Western Europe and the US. That has sparked some very strong fears about how that process is unsettling social norms, challenging communities. And deprivation taps this notion of relative deprivation, that it's not how much money you have or what you've objectively got in your pocket or in your bank balance, but is actually about a sense that you are being left behind relative to others in society. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the Brexit vote, people who felt that compared to others, they were being left behind, even if they were on good incomes, were overwhelmingly more likely to vote for Leave. Whereas those who felt that they were doing reasonably okay compared to others, or even better than others, basically were far more likely to vote to Remain. Now, what I'm not saying is this is all about the white working class, because it isn't, because relative deprivation taps lots of people. Mm. Relatively affluent middle-class conservatives might feel that they're not actually getting what they perhaps feel entitled to, or that they feel that they deserve compared to other groups. And lastly, de-alignment, which is a way in which our political systems are de-aligning. And what we mean by that is that the bonds between traditional parties and the people are breaking, and they're becoming much weaker. So if I said to you, do you feel strongly attached to a particular party? You might say to me, well, Matt, yes, I do. Well, you're a think tanker and you're in you're in Westminster and you're an outlier. Most people now, I think, reply, well, I might have a weak attachment, or I might not have any attachment at all. And this is now reaching some pretty striking levels. In Sweden, its percentage of identifiers is down to 27%. In the US, the share of independents is at a record high. In Germany, the number of non-aligned voters across generations is at a record high. So when you say to me, well, look at all this volatility and these new parties breaking through, I say, well, it's not a surprise, because we don't have the stickiness, we don't have the glue, we don't have the tribal loyalty in politics that we used to have. And to be frank, I'm not entirely sure that it's going to come back.
Well, one of the lessons is, national populism can work inside and outside the system. So you can have a Trump-style thing where you take over an established party, or you can have a new party that you keep winning European elections.
Well, that's absolutely that's the point. Now, this is a subtle, nuanced point, but one I think has a lot of power, which is that, where's Western Europe going, right? When we have parties like Five Star in Italy that can be founded and win an election within 10 years, that's highly significant. When we have Emmanuel Macron, who can step outside the party system, start a new movement, become president within 2 years, that's highly significant. That tells us that volatility is very high. I think one possible future for Western Europe might actually be in Central and Eastern Europe. And what I mean by that is you don't have the strong tribal allegiances there. You don't have the deep roots. You don't have strong party identification. And so what you see in those systems is constant churn, new parties winning and then getting replaced by even newer parties, and those parties getting replaced by even newer parties. And it becomes a cycle, an ongoing cycle of churn and change. I'm not saying Britain will go down that way, because we have a very strong two-party system, although we do have a lot of volatility under the headlines, a lot of voters moving around underneath the first-past-the-post system. But lots of systems in Western Europe are looking pretty vulnerable right now. AfD in Germany comes out of nowhere almost to take over 90 seats in the Bundestag, is now in 15 of Germany's 16 state parliaments. If you'd said that to me in the late 90s, that Germany would have a populist party at that level of success, I probably would have laughed you out of the room, because the old argument was that Germany has these social norms that basically defend it against populism because of the Nazis and the Second World War. So it's a very interesting moment for Europe. I think we're in a very fragile place, and I'm not entirely convinced that where we're heading is going to just be a resurgence of strong and stable mainstream centre politics.
So we've got, and in those 4Ds, basically it's kind of half questions of how politics is done, right? So how parties work, how representative politicians are, and so on. And then half of it is substantive policy, economics, and so on. In the deprivation and the destruction points.
Yeah.
Clearly the biggest issue, if you're going to point at one issue, one actual policy area, clearly the biggest issue is immigration. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you, can you imagine kind of defeating populism, if that's something someone wanted to do? Can you imagine doing that without taking serious substantive action on immigration policy? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
There is an argument which is, it's about the messaging, and it's about being in touch with people and listening to people. Does that version work, or is it just a question of, there's only so much immigration voters will take?
I think your question is alluding to a very interesting debate that we've had over the last 2 years since those big political shocks in 2016, which is this all about economics or is it about culture? And that debate is raging in the social sciences. And if you lean a little bit left or very left, you say it's economics. If you basically are sort of centre-right, you tend to say, well, it's mainly about culture and migration. And the debate is raging. We argue you can't separate the two and that the real world doesn't really work that way. But the most important driver is indeed migration and worries over how it's affecting nation states, changing nation states, and also how ethnic change is unsettling societies. Can you fix it without dealing with immigration? No, I don't think you can. I think the response that democracies like Sweden and Denmark are going to get into, I think, will be lowering overall migration, working harder on integration policies, and allowing a new national story, a national community, in effect, to have time to integrate and before then perhaps progressing with change. This is what we saw in the US at the beginning of the early 20th century. The overall share of the population that was foreign-born was about 13%. And during the Kennedy and Johnson eras, it then basically declines and then begins to increase again to where we are today. It's about 14-15%, and it will get up to about 18-19% in the coming years. But America had that period where, through the civil rights era and also through the 50s, 60s, 70s, they were at least able to build this sort of national story, this integrated community. I think Europe might be in a sort of similar point. I mean, Europe has got a lot of challenges, but one is how do you build those integrated societies and actually respond to public concerns over migration and the refugee crisis, people clearly wanting greater external security, if not in the coming years, I would suggest internal security. It's going to be difficult for Europe to deliver on that, but it's also going to be difficult because Europe is aging, especially Central and East European states. They are depopulating. If you look at Lithuania, if you look at Bulgaria, if you look at Estonia, if you look at Hungary, some of those states are forecast to shrink effectively by up to 40% by 2040 or 2050. That is going to have a considerable effect on social care systems, tax base, all that kind of stuff. So they have two options. One is they lure people back from Western Europe. The other is that they have significant inward migration. Perhaps a third, actually, as they increase their birth rate and they try and increase the growth of their population. But those are basically the only options. Now, why I think that's tricky for Europe is because those are exactly the same states that are the most likely to feel anxious about all of this change anyway. So how are they going to navigate that dilemma? I don't know what the answer is. Those states will not be able to have restrictive migration policies because they don't really have any migration to begin with, really. Western Europe, I think they'll have to increasingly adopt a more conservative approach on these issues, and we're already seeing that, right? I mean, Macron is the outlier. Europe, I think, is moving right quite quickly.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And I think moving on a bit in the argument, the most important point you make in your book is, or at least the message that needs to get through to people, if there is one, is that this is not a flash in the pan. So this is not just a Do you remember 2016 when suddenly
when everything went crazy? Yeah.
You know, basically that populism is here to stay.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because of these deep-rooted currents that we are underestimating, and also, you know, even in 2016, people forgot that, you know, this period of political change began in the 80s and the 90s, and for those of us with longer political memories, you know, I'm sure listeners will remember Jean-Marie Le Pen in France. They'll remember Jörg Haider in Austria. They'll remember Umberto Bossi in Italy. They'll remember the progress parties in Scandinavia. And the consensus, certainly among most of the academics, is that the current wave of national populism really began in the late 70s and the early 80s, and basically it's gathered pace. And 2016 was really a kind of crescendo moment, if you like. And that, to me, says that, you know, as we go into those European Parliament elections next spring, as we go into the next round of elections in Germany or in Italy or even Sweden and Netherlands, these parties are going to be, I would argue, relatively permanent features on the political landscape. They can have one of two effects. They can either start winning elections outright, as they're doing in Italy, or they can actually drag the mainstream over to their positions, as they're doing in some countries, like you might argue Britain. I mean, the Conservative Party, you could argue, has been fundamentally reshaped after the rise of the UK Independence Party and the vote for Brexit. I mean, there were always these traditions within the Conservative Party, but I would think Mayism, if there is such a thing, and I'm not entirely convinced there is, but was partly a response to a moment that was partly shaped by national populism.
And then one of the consequences of the fact that they're here to stay and they're winning is that the argument and the politics will evolve to a point where basically populists aren't just outsiders trying to get elected on a promise of radical change, but they're actually fighting elections on their record in office. Donald Trump's obviously the most prominent example of that. And so you've got this kind of chilling, if you're a sort of centrist, a chilling thought that, you know, what if populists are elected? We all thought that these policies were crazy, but actually the voters quite like the policies. And, you know, it would be a mistake to discount that possibility.
I think you're right to point to that. I think the issue that we had, you know, I mean, go back to Blair. In some ways it all begins with Blair. But if you think about where we are with Brexit and everything now, and you think about the Blair argument, what did Blair really say to voters? He said that you're on a bullet train, it's called globalization, and it's going 3,000 miles an hour, and you can't get off. Mm-hmm. That's what he said, effectively. That's the third way. It's here to stay, it's inevitable, get on with it. Some voters over the last 5 years have discovered through national populism or simply by withdrawing from politics altogether that they can get off the train, or they can at least slow it down, and the result is not Armageddon. And this is the awkward point for centrists and for mainstream operators, which is Trump, whatever your politics, right? He's a divisive guy, but America has not yet disintegrated because he's in the White House. Italy has not yet disintegrated because Matteo Salvini is in government. Britain has not yet disintegrated because people said, I want to leave supranational integration. I want to leave the European Union. This has now created what I would argue is an alternative state for people, an alternative way, if you like, of being that, picking up on Catherine de Vries's arguments, who's a political scientist, you know, she makes this very interesting point that Brexit is partly an alternative state for Europe. Now, it might not seem it at the moment because we're following the minutiae of the negotiation, but 10 years from now, 20 years from now, there will be an alternative state, and it will be awkward for the European Union, for other member states, for people that are looking, and maybe Britain will not have collapsed and be thriving, and that will be awkward. But in the same way, national populism is an alternative state for people, and if anything, you know, credibility is important. And what your ordinary voter has learned over the last 5 years is that if you vote for these parties, the roof doesn't necessarily fall in.
And all the data suggests that if the roof falls in a little bit, they're fine with that. I mean, that they are willing to sacrifice, specifically they're willing to sacrifice economic growth to some degree.
Well, we latched on to rational choice theory, particularly with Brexit. We said, this is all about GDP. People didn't vote to be poorer. Well, no, but they voted for other things. Mm-hmm. And this wasn't an economic cost-benefit choice. This was about reclaiming sovereignty for national institutions. It was about lowering migration. It was about gaining greater control over the nation. And it was about distancing the country from what leavers perceived to be external risks within the EU, whether those were distant institutions, whether it was immigration, free movement, whether it was terrorism, whether it was non-elected governments, whether it was a dismissive European elite, whatever it was. But, you know, they clearly were focused on external risk. Remain have since, in my view at least, not really reflected on that point and have doubled down on the argument that this is about economic cost-benefit analysis. And clearly voters have told us it's not. I just think there's been a complete lack of imagination within the political debate. Like, how would you apply? I mean, how would you have replied as a political operator to Brexit, right? What would you have done in response to the vote to leave? I think I probably would have said, well, let's have electoral reform. Maybe we should move some institutions outside of London. Maybe we need to think about why coastal communities have had no inward investment for 30 years. Maybe we need to think about reforming immigration. Maybe we need to even go further and have more referendums at the local or regional level, or citizens' assembly instead of the House of Lords, whatever it is. What was the reply? There has been no reply. And that's a problem, because a set of demands have been put on the table, and at some point, as a society, as a community, as a nation, we are going to have to deliver a convincing and compelling reply.
Do you think part of the problem is people kind of, this sounds silly, but they're just sort of overthinking it all, in the sense that there's, you get, you know, in America especially, you get very over-the-top warnings about what Donald Trump is. Similarly, you get over-the-top warnings about what Brexit represents. And so people forget just to sort of listen to the voters, rather than, you know, sort of overthinking the nature of the threat to democracy.
I think there's certainly a there's a tendency to descend into alarmism almost immediately. I mean, we've seen that in Britain, where every major electoral contest, pretty much since the 2014 independence referendum in Scotland, has been based on fear of some description. And I think we are now dealing with voters who are immune to those narratives, that voters are not just going to go along with this descent into alarmism and, in some point, you know, hysteria. You know, the US, I think, my own personal view at least, and we talk about it in the book, the US has responded very poorly to Trump. The Democrats have doubled down in the same way that I think Remain have doubled down in Britain. But now they've kind of got themselves into a cul-de-sac, and there's no way back once Trump starts wheeling out his next offer. And, you know, Trump will have an offer for voters. He's got a lot to say. Personally, I'm not a big fan of Trump, but from a strategy point of view, he's got tax cuts, he's got a conservative Supreme Court, he's building a wall on the southern border, he's standing up to China, he's standing up to the EU, he's asking other nations to pay more. Now, you know, if you are Trump's strategist and you just whittle down all these things that he's done, there's an offer. There's an offer there for conservative Americans, right? What's the counter-offer? Because so far it seems the counter-offer is basically, well, Trump is a narcissistic, terrible human being. Well, that's priced in. Right, people know that, right? It's a priced-in factor. So what's the new offer? And I think that gets us into the more interesting conversation about, well, how can social democracy and the centre-left respond to this moment where people have clearly concluded that they want conservatives or they want national populists to be in government? What's the offer? What's the new idea? The Third Way captured the kind of mid to late 1990s, early 2000s zeitgeist. You know, the rise of globalization and how the left can accommodate itself to market forces. Well, what's today's zeitgeist?
If we go along with your theory that the populists are here to stay, assuming we, especially people don't sort of learn the right lessons, is that a less democratic political place?
I think, you know, to be honest, and this is going to make me very unpopular among my friends on the left, that I think the jury is out. I think the jury is out, because populism is also a corrective. This is the controversial argument that people really don't like to engage with. But thinkers like Margaret Canavan and Laclau and others have this nice argument, I think, which is that populism can be restorative. It can rejuvenate democracy when issues are left off the table, when groups feel that they're not represented. Sometimes, you know, political systems move so far away from these groups or these issues that they need to be snapped back. And populism kind of serves that function. So Canavan, for example, who sadly passed away this year, argued that as long as we have democracy, we will have populism in one form or another. We might have a few quiet years, we might have a few loud years, but we will always have that because there are irreconcilable tensions within democracy, that there will always be groups that feel they're not at the table, or there'll always be these tensions that get mobilized. So, I mean, I'm not of the school that says all of this is absolutely terrible, all of this is a return to historic fascism, which it clearly isn't, and all of this is an outward eruption of racism. I think the data points in a very different direction. Our societies are becoming less racist, not more racist. But it does mean we need to take the underlying grievances a lot more seriously, and some of those are legitimate, and we need to deal with that.
That was Matthew Goodwin on national populism. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.